Hi, welcome to Alaska Radio Reader Rambler, a monthly potpourri of literary snacks for the mind and interviews. I'm Sandy Harper here with my co-host Dick Reichman, and today our guest is the legendary, beyond triple threat, actor, singer, dancer, but a director, writer, producer, as well as the public persona of Mr. Art Matters, one of my favorite people in the whole world, Mr. Ed Bourgeois.
Gosh, good morning.
Good morning.
I was going to say, well, I'm here too, other than this imaginary legendary person you're describing.
Oh, you are legendary, Ed. I mean, your history in Anchorage goes way, 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 way back, from Elvis to the opera to the Alaska Native Heritage Center to, of course, many, many things at Cyrano's that we've loved.
To the 80s. We remember the 80s.
Yeah, that was too long ago. I don't remember that. Mm-hmm.
That's what happens when you get older.
The 1880s or the 1980s?
But, you know, it sounds like that there's a theater DNA running in your family legacy, that your son Caleb is also going into the family business.
He is. He, in fact, has just directed at Out North, Spring Awakening, which opened last weekend, and I highly recommend. It's a wonderful, wonderful piece and a wonderful job that he did with it. And then we open Gold Rush Girls, which I'm directing.
And in as well.
And also in, by chance.
But what's unique about Gold Rush Girls, it is a premiere piece. Nobody's ever done it on stage before. So maybe we can talk a little bit about what it's like to be help create a new work.
Sure. It's really exciting. As a director, you really approach every piece as a new piece. The words on the page are the words on the page, and bringing them to life is your job, interpreting that. So I kind of look at every script as a new piece. But this is truly different because there's no reference other than the historical research. You know, the best research for this piece is the book that it's based on by Lael Morgan.
Yes, the wonderful Good Time Girls,
wonderful book. Yeah. And what a wealth of background material. Oh, no. It really is has been the most valuable tool I've had, is just to read that book.
Yeah, she's famous for her research. Mm-hmm. She actually won a Historian of the Year when it was first published. Mm-hmm.
The real gem for me is having the writers here in Anchorage during the rehearsal process, and it's been really, really wonderful to collaborate with them. They've been working on this piece for a long, long time.
Yeah, it's been incubating, mm-hmm. but never on stage before as a production.
Right. I understand there have been readings of it, but mm-hmm. they've never seen it on its feet. And so as writers, during the rehearsal process, as we work, they're illuminated too. They see things work or not work the way they imagined, and they have the ability then to make adjustments during the process, which you don't do. You don't change Shakespeare. But but here, having the writers here has been really wonderful because we've got a great cast that has been very flexible and willing to, you know, it's unusual in that way. Usually performers memorize their lines as written, and that's it.
And this is the blocking.
And that's it, right. Yeah. And they get their blocking, and that's it. Yeah. It's an extra burden, frankly, to have to make changes for a performer. And yet they've all been really wonderful about embracing that.
Well, you have an extraordinary cast, mm-hmm. the talent. And we should also mention this is a musical, so Jerry is the composer. And that makes it even more unique and special.
Yeah, Jerry and Carmo are a married couple. He's the composer, she's the writer of the book, of the words, they're just wonderfully complementary, or they complement each other really well. They're two very different personality types. She's a performer, it's really obvious when you meet her. She's got that energy, and has a very specific image of what it looks like, what the piece looks like. And Jerry, musically, has the same very specific focus. He knows what it's supposed to sound like.
And it sounds gorgeous. This music's really beautiful.
Yeah. Well, Dan McElrath is the music director, and he's worked with Jerry now for a while. I think they worked at a distance before Jerry and Carmo came to town. And so they did some work in advance together, creating the orchestrations and making changes and adapting keys and all those sorts of things that you do musically that are generally those things are set when you work on a musical that's been done before. But because this is a new piece, it's still a little in flux.
Which is fabulous. And they have bonded. They really have.
Oh, yeah. It's been great having them here. Everyone's bonded with them.
How does it deal with the book? The book, as I recall, is a bunch of different stories. How does the musical cut through that and become one show?
We call it inspired rather than based on. But
yeah, they are fictional characters that are in the play that we're doing, but they're sort of an amalgam of all these different stories. So it's not trying to tell any of the specific real life stories of particular girls, Klondike Kate, or a lot of the women who are described in the book. It's a fictional character, but it's the play is informed by all of that detail, all of those stories. Every once in a while, Carmel will call the character of Barker, who's the villain, she'll call him Soapy.
Yes.
Because in her writing, in her initial drafts, she referred to him as Soapy. Soapy Smith. Uh-huh. That was the inspiration for the character of Barker, although it's not supposed to be Soapy Smith.
Right.
But she still kind of slips every once in a while.
That kind of guy,
and says,
though.
Yeah, Soapy. You know, Soapy, the guy that would be this way.
Yeah. And Ed is also playing that part.
Well, and that's another story, yeah. We cast the production, and then a couple of our principal actors had to withdraw. One got cast in a piece at Perseverance,
mm-hmm.
and another got...
the
opportunity to go fishing and make some money. So, you know, actors don't usually have that chance.
Right.
So, you know, circumstances arose that took a couple of people out of the production. And we had our first reading. And at the first reading, there was no one to read the part of Barker. So I just, as the director, I just read it. And
you were so perfect.
Well, and then everyone just said, you should just play the part.
And we're so glad you said
well,
yes.
Well, it didn't take much leg pulling because it's a wonderfully written part.
It is.
And it's always fun to play the bad guy. So so I stepped in, but that's not without its challenges, huge challenges. You know, yeah, I think on the first page of how to direct, the manual of how to direct, it says, you know, don't act and direct in the same production.
Oh.
It's one of the cardinal cardinal rules of directing. Don't try to be in the production too, because you can't be in two places at once. You can't be on the stage and looking at the stage.
Because it's
the same
your third
time.
Eye that's part.
Yeah, you have to be able to see what's happening on stage, and when I'm on stage, I can't. So the only way that really could happen was by having Carmo and Jerry here. So we really kind of have three directors. You know, I'm not really directing the show. I'm a partner in directing the show with them, because I'm on stage two-thirds of the time, and I have to rely on Carmo's eye.
And she's got a great eye for detail.
And she's got a great eye.
The collaboration in this show is so exciting. Of course, mm-hmm. theater is about collaboration, but mm-hmm. you know, we have the choreographer as well, who.
Hannah Gauthier, yeah.
Yes. Oh, and a little side story on that. Hannah also choreographed Caleb's show.
Yeah, it's a very small town, isn't it? Yeah. she choreographed Spring Awakening, and that had sort of set pieces.
Mm-hmm.
So she was able to do that work and then step out just at about the time we were beginning our rehearsals. And I think we've placed a lot more demands on her time, because as a new piece... You know, we're inventing everything.
But it's so exuberant and joyous and fun.
It really, well, it's a great story. It's really a well-written book, and the music is infectious. It's just, it really, really is a lot of fun. I'm sure this piece is going to go places, because the music is a real toe-tapper. It really is fun.
It really is. And of course, that is the aspiration and dream of Jerry and Carmel, is to take it beyond the borders of Alaska.
Mm.
Find that gold at the end of the rainbow on Broadway, I tell Carmel. We all want to be invited front row center, Broadway
right.
theater, and celebrate at Sardi's one day.
Yeah, that's what we talk about when, you know, Cyrano's is, if you've been to Cyrano's, you mm-hmm. know, it's a certain size space. It has certain restrictions, you know, it doesn't have... spotlights and banks and banks of lights and, you know, all the moving set pieces and the fly system that they'll have on Broadway. So you adjust your production to your space. And
very often. Great set.
I'm really excited. Everything about it is wonderful. Mm. Brian Saylor designed a beautiful set. His daughter Anda just came in yesterday and made some beautiful painting and different touches to I'm really, really happy.
Right.
But what I mean is, you know, when Carmo says, "Well, we need a lot of light here," you know, I'll say, "Well, when it's on Broadway, you're going to have all of that, and you'll have that set piece that flies away and all of those things."
But you have to be resourceful and creative, and that's also a wonderful thing. And of course, the lighting, we have a resident lighting guy, Frank Hardy, and he, dazzling Northern Lights.
I am amazed, and I'm sure he will not divulge or share that secret of how he possibly can make Northern Lights. And it's without projection. It's with lighting instruments.
He does with Goebbels and his imagination.
And it moves.
And his, you know, knowledge of lighting in our house.
But, you know, a piece really should, to be successful, you know, and move on and go to other places and be picked up by regional theaters and whatnot, it's helpful to work it in a small space and know that it can be done in a small space. You can always expand. Mm-hmm. You can always make things more complicated and greater effects and spend a lot of money making things really dazzling. But if it doesn't work on a small scale, then it's hard to sell, you know. And, you know, I work with playwrights at the Native Heritage Center, and we tell them at the beginning of the process, unlimited imagination. Anything you want, but when you're doing a final work on a piece, then you need to start thinking about, can you really have 47 people in this scene? If not really, because if you do, you might want to think about trimming that back. And you know, the piece that has 4 to 7 characters is going to be a lot easier for a producer to pick up and afford to produce.
Right, extraordinary special effects are another thing.
Right.
Volcano explodes.
Right, and that's where we say, well, when it's on Broadway, you can have your chorus of 47 dancing girls, you know. But for now, what works, how does the story work? And
yes,
how does it work in its most distilled form? And that's what's important, and that's what you'll see at Cyrano's. We don't have a huge cast. In fact, I'm amazed that in this town where we have, knowing that we have a show with half-naked ladies, that we couldn't find a whole lot of men willing to audition. I thought they'd just be dropping out of the ceiling. But we have a very small cast. And but it fills the space in Cyrano's. It's really wonderful.
It absolutely does. I know you wanted more minors, but the minors you have, they're a crowd, and each is such a unique character.
Right.
That's what I love about it.
And that's what the beauty of the script is. It's not men's chorus.
Mm-hmm.
Each of those minors is named specifically. Each one has their own real specific characterization character qualities, and their own way of speaking, their own lines. It's really, and that's a testament to the writer, that she's crafted really, really carefully crafted real people.
Exactly.
It would be easy to say men's chorus, and there's just a bunch of scruffy guys, you know, with gold pans and and pirate accents, you know. But in this case, she's created very specific characters,
and the costuming reflects that too.
It's all falling together this week. We open shortly, and so, you know, the last few days before opening are always a little crazy, because everything that you've pretended is there is suddenly there. All of the props are there. All of the you know, in a saloon, we're pouring drinks all the time. So all of a sudden, in rehearsal, you're not using water or iced tea, whatever you use to make whiskey. You're using the real thing. And it creates a lot of additional
layers.
You mean
the real iced tea, not the
real iced tea.
I thought you said you were drinking whiskey on the show. So
I guess I made it sound that way, didn't I?
But also, go ahead.
If the cast doesn't drink whiskey, the tickets should be a little cheaper, right?
They would all be laying on the floor at the end, because this is a typical Gold Rush paradise bar.
Oh,
singing, dancing, and drinking, and card playing.
Right.
And it's a very unique universe. Of course, our opening night will have happened by the time the show goes on the air, and we will have had real madams in the audience because Leo's friends with real working madams. And who knows who else will be there? So
now, Ed, if the plan is to take this show beyond Alaska, what does that mean? I mean, every show that we do at Cyrano's, we do a lot of originals there. We hope to take it beyond Alaska, but really we just kind of hope that that Broadway producer happens to show up and happens to walk in. And mm-hmm. I presume that you are doing more than that in the hopes to make this a nationwide production or show.
Well, you know,
what's happening?
Personally, I'm not involved at that level. I'm working on this production for Cyrano's here.
Make it the best possible we can.
But I do know that they have a whole machinery going behind the scenes, so to speak, that where they are contacting producers, contacting theaters, trying to get the script read. And that's the process, as you know, Dick, for a playwright. You know, you're always trying to get someone in the position of the decision-making position at a major theater, at a regional theater, at in New York or L.A. or San Diego, wherever, to read your script, and they get millions of them. I know some dramaturgs from different regional companies, mm-hmm. and their desks and their waste baskets are piled high with scripts that come in all the time. I think it helps right now as they send scripts out, that there is a production on its feet in Anchorage, Alaska. And if someone reads that and it piques their interest and they want to see something, they want to see more or hear more, well, we just happen to have a production going right now. So I think they're sort of redoubling their efforts and pushing real hard right now to get the script in the hands of producers. And they've been working with the dramaturg to tighten it up.
That's correct. And that is, again, one reason we could not call it a world premiere, because that has leverage and prestige if they were able to successfully get it produced on Broadway or mm-hmm. large regional theater. So we're calling it national premiere.
Yeah, a Broadway producer doesn't want to say the almost world premiere after Cyrano's in Anchorage, Alaska.
Although, you know, Alaska has cachet, and I think that's part of its appeal nationally, that this is real authentic Alaskan Gold Rush musical.
Well, and particularly the subject of the piece. I mean, it's about the Gold Rush. Which is sort of the state theme, right? Mm-hmm. After the state flower and the state song, Gold Rush is pretty important stuff. So
they call oil black gold.
Yeah, you're not going to premiere. I can't see premiering this piece in Florida or Texas.
No.
You know, it really sort of needs to find its life here, and then I think it has a great chance of being looked at and picked up, because it really is. It's a really tight piece. Other than little minor changes that are being made, a few little new lines here and there to make a particular moment work better.
Right, and it is a musical, and it's the music that's mm-hmm. extraordinary. Mm-hmm.
Ed Bourgeois is our guest, and we're talking about Gold Rush Girls. Ed, you know, when I first came to Alaska in the 80s, there were around the state in the summertime a bunch of shows about Gold Rush. And that was kind of tourist currency mm-hmm. in those days. I don't know if any of those are still going. Maybe the Skagway show is still mm-hmm. going. But I know when I mention this show to Alaskan people, they immediately think, oh, this must be a show for Alaskan tourists. Not necessary for me to go, since I'm an Alaskan. Address that. Is this an Alaskan tourist show or no?
It's everything. It will work for tourists. In fact, I hope tourists come that are in Anchorage are going to will just see the title and automatically
come. It's cultural tourism in that sense.
It is cultural tourism in that sense, but that's not why it was written. And that's not the only level at which it works. It is a piece of really brilliant theater about a fascinating story of that time, and you really get it when you think about Lael's book, because mm-hmm. that's from the perspective of the women at that time. You know, we all know that every guy with a little bit of wanderlust or wanting to make a million at that time was attracted to the Gold Rush. People came from all over the world to Dawson and to Fairbanks and Nome when that was happening, because it was their chance to win the lottery of the time, mm-hmm. right? And we don't know much, or we don't think much about, well, how intrepid did a woman have to be at that time? In if great you imagine the social mores and, yes. And what an independent woman of that time had to go, you know, what they would go through. What did it mean for them to leave home and go, and yet they're the ones that ended up, you read Lael's book,
yes.
There, a lot of them are the ones that ended up keeping their wealth. You know, men came and they had all this incredible gold they just pulled out of the water, out of the ground, and they spent it as quick as they got it. A lot of them ended up broke over and over and over again. A lot of these women, they were the gold diggers. They were the ones that made the money off the miners. And some of their stories are just heartbreaking and touching, and you know, it's not something that ended right there at that time. The story continues, of the book continues into modern times. So it continues right up into Anchorage in the 70s, you know, when that business was pretty strong here, and the line in Fairbanks. Anyone from Fairbanks knows about the line, the district that was created where these women were allowed to own their own land. They were allowed to own their own businesses before women in the rest of the country had any rights
and
like that.
And to vote 7 years before.
So it's a fascinating story on its own. It just happens to be about a period of time that tourism in Anchorage takes advantage of. You know, it's a marketable story for tourism.
It's a romantic time in many people's
but
eyes.
But it's a brilliant story for all audiences.
I totally agree with you.
It really is. And its strength is, it could be set in any time. It has a great protagonist, a great antagonist. It's got wonderful dialogue, brilliant songs. Mm-hmm. It could work. It could be about another subject and be immediately successful. So it happens to be about the gold rush, and that will happen to help it be successful marketing-wise mm-hmm. during the summer in Anchorage, Alaska, because we have tourists here. But it's also very different from, now, I don't want to do a disservice to those shows. I know that a lot of them were in towns in Southeast along where the cruise lines come to port. And so they were sort of the entertainment, the expected entertainment. And they were, I would imagine they were written from the miners, from the point of view of the gold rushers, of the people who came to Alaska for the gold rush, right? And the Can-Can girls and all of that, the Soapy Smiths and Dan McGrews. This story has a unique element, which is that there is an Alaska Native character of Knuntuk that tells a different side of the story that you might not expect, and I would imagine is probably not in any of those other shows. You know, outsiders come to Alaska, and very often what they know of Alaska is Gold Rush, or they imagine Eskimos and igloos is the only context they might have for anything Alaska Native. And Carmo is written in a really, really interesting character who happens to be deceased. So she's a spirit who's part of the action, who's on the periphery and influencing what's happening. And it educates in a really, really subtle way about other things that were happening here at the time and continue to happen today. So there's a layer of sophistication there that's way beyond what I imagine an entertainment piece for tourists.
Yeah, it's not the quick stereotype by any means.
No.
There's a great authenticity and complexity in the characters as well.
Yeah.
You know, and I know they want a Broadway proscenium ultimately, but I think there's great power and charm in the intimacy of a smaller theater, because when you're right there, you're in the paradise when you come to this theater.
Absolutely, and it's the first time I've been involved in a musical mm-hmm. in Cyrano's. It's really interesting how as a performer, it frees you to really explore in a different way.
Mm-hmm.
How do I say this? when you're on a proscenium stage doing a musical and there's a full orchestra, you sing out at a certain level that's not really appropriate at Cyrano's. If we all sing out like we would in the Discovery, in the Atwood Theater, we'd blow people through the back walls. You know, it's going to be overpowering. And so it's really wonderful to be able to play vocally mm-hmm. with singing very, very, with not having to push vocally, to be able to be really subtle with your voice in ways that would be too quiet in a big theater.
You can do movie acting in there.
Yeah. Absolutely, yeah.
And it's also because the acoustics are so excellent. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. You know, it does drive me crazy to see musicals, everybody mic'd, you know, they're mic'd. Mm-hmm. In this case, they are not mic'd.
Oh, not at all, no. Yeah. Nothing's mic'd.
Yeah.
Well, and nothing should be. You know, it would be too big. The only sort of enhancement we have at all is that the piano, we have a monitor from the piano so that we can actually hear. Mm-hmm. You know, we pipe it backstage so we can hear what the piano is playing when right. we're singing.
Yeah, and that's one of their contemporary really touches that the music score is on one of those tablets. You know,
yeah,
there's not a page turner with
frankly,
music.
I have never seen that. The music director has the score on an iPad. And so rather than flipping pages, he's touching his screen to move the...
Isn't it something?
Can he be sure to get the right one? When I touch an iPad, it goes to the wrong page.
Yeah, I would be a little afraid, too. And I'm going to make sure there's a charger at hand, too.
Good idea. See, that's the director speaking now.
But Dan is Dan's great, and he's a wonderful musician. I've only known him when I was at the opera. I knew Dan as the Steinway piano tuner.
That's right.
He's sort of got the market, statewide market on tuning Steinways across the state.
Your competition, Dick. Dick also tunes pianos.
And harpsichords.
That's right.
Yeah, that's right.
But I had no idea Dan was the kind of player he is, and he's got a jazz band, so
yes.
he does.
He's a play all the time. Guy.
Yeah, but he's doing really wonderfully with this musical theater idiom, and we're having a great time.
I mean, we were so blessed. His knowledge and his talent. Plus, he's created the illusion of a period piano around his keyboard.
Oh yeah, yeah. He has an electronic keyboard, mm-hmm. which we found was working better than an actual acoustic piano, because he can. He can enhance it in certain ways. He doesn't have an orchestra. We worked on finding some other musicians, and we may have a fiddler who joins us during the run. You know, ideally, we might have had a banjo player, a squeeze box player.
Yes.
But right now, it's just the piano. So he's able to do a little extra work with a synthesizer that helps enhance.
Yeah. Oh, I'm getting signaled that we have to conclude our conversation. There's so much more to talk about, such as there is going to be another incestuous element. Caleb's going to step in for a weekend.
Yes,
as an
he's
actor.
An understudy because we have someone who can't be there for a couple weekends of the performance. So he's going to be joining us in this production,
so
too.
So that's very wonderful, the father-son relationship and working together. Thank you so much for joining us, Ed.
It is my pleasure.
And join us again next month for another episode of Alaska Radio Reader Rambler.